today on The Frame Weekend. She can sing rock and roll, but also Mexican folk songs, pop standards, and even opera. That's Linda Ronstadt, and she's the subject of a new documentary.
She is an artist, and I think she was just restless and unsatisfied to keep repeating what she'd been doing in the past. She describes it as having to sing the same thing over and over again until it starts to sound like your washing machine.
Plus, Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones starred in The Theory of Everything. Now they're back together riding in a hot air balloon in the new movie, The Aeronauts.
A vast amount of it is the two of us in a basket about the size of a sort of small table. And when you're spending 3 months in said basket, you need to really get on with the person that you're doing it with.
And we hit a karaoke bar with filmmaker Justin Chan. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Okay, let's do it. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. Later today, a new documentary about Linda Ronstadt reminds you how much you love her and her voice, which seems to have no limit on what it can do. But first, let the fall film festival season begin.
You all love twisting the knife into one another.
I'm sorry it's so late.
Miss Carr.
No, please. I'm Judy.
Suppose Henry Ford II wanted to build the greatest race car the world's ever seen.
What I love about Nicole. Loving you. She's a great dancer.
Kids, it's time to burn some books.
Would you like to pick a new name to mark your freedom?
Harriet Tubman.
My mother always tells me to smile and put on a happy face.
I intend to make my own way in the world.
No one makes their own way, least of all a woman. You'll need to marry well.
But you are not married, aren't you?
Well, that's because I'm rich.
Last weekend, a few of us from The Frame spent Labor Day covering the 46th annual Telluride Film Festival in Colorado. We banked a ton of interviews and saw a lot of movies, and among them was The Aeronauts. It stars Felicity Jones and Eddie Redmayne. The last time they made a movie together, it was the Stephen Hawking story, The Theory of Everything. Both of them got Oscar nominations, and Redmayne won for playing Hawking. In their new film, they played 19th century balloonists.
Miss Wren, I need to make studies of the air.
I'm not a coachman for hire.
You are the only person who could fly us higher than anyone has ever been. So will you?
So my first question is, do you come in together or does one join the aeronauts first? Do you like say, I'm in if you're in?
That's a really good question.
Yeah. I thought you meant flying to Telluride. Yeah. I was like, we did come together, in fact. We were obviously sent it separately, read it separately. Both had a very positive response to it. I think we both found there were aspects of the character that we jumped at, yeah. of the two characters. And then we had, we called up on the phone and had a chat about it.
We called each other. We're like, should we do this?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the main thing was, in a sense, was kind of, if you do it, then I'll do it.
Yeah.
That seemed to be the overriding conclusion from
because this film is basically a vast amount of it is the two of us in a basket about the size of a sort of small table. And when you're spending 3 months in said basket, you need to really get on with the person that you're doing it with. And also, what was lovely, Felicity and I, having worked together on Theory of Everything, was to trust each other, but also be able to push each other to make it something new.
Yeah, I think it suddenly felt like it suddenly had a new dimension to it, working with someone that you'd already worked with before. It sort of felt, I remember early on we were talking about the African Queen and talking about that dynamic between those two actors. And it sort of, there was something sort of quite old Hollywood about reuniting.
Unlike Theory of Everything, there are, I don't know, compressions, I guess would be a fair way to say. So, Felicity, about your character, how much of it is based on a historical person? How much is a composition? And when you're thinking about what you can capture from reality, how much is there available for you in terms of reference and research?
Well, there was enormous amount of resources, but the single person that was such an inspiration for Amelia was this woman called Sophie Blanchard, who was one of the first women. She was French, one of the first women to fly solo in a gas air balloon, and she was absolutely crazy and used to do these night flights and throw fireworks out of the balloon basket. Actually, till her death at the end, she actually killed herself by throwing a firework out of the balloon, which then set on fire, and she fell and hit the rooftops of Paris and fell to her death. But luckily, that doesn't happen to Amelia Wren.
Oh, does it?
But there was definitely that daredevil streak that I was just essential for playing Amelia.
There's an amazing story about Sophie Blanchard as well, that she was Napoleon's favourite aeronaut. Yeah. And once she went up in a basket the size of a champagne bucket in a diaphanous gown and just floated over the battlefield just to freak out the opponents, basically.
Well, Napoleon thought they could use gas air balloons to invade England, and she was going to be leading the invasion.
And Eddie, what about your character? I mean, he is somebody who is also a historical figure who's trying to figure out meteorology, this crazy concept that you can predict the weather. In fact, he's, you know, probably the first person in the world who is thinking about climate change. But how much of his life is based on your character, and how much are you inventing?
Well, the whole piece, there is a beautiful book called Falling Upwards, which is a history of air ballooning. And what the that was the basis for the film, and the film itself is a conflation of all of these extraordinary true stories together. And so James Glaisher's flight, which the film specifically is based on, did happen. And Glaisher was the son of a watchmaker from Rotherhithe, and his ambition and his drive was something that I looked into, but I'm sort of 20 years younger than he was, so there was a certain amount of research, and then there was just a freedom to kind of use that as a bounce board, really. To I don't even know what a bounce board is, but to springboard.
Sounds fun.
We're talking with Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones at Telluride about their new film, The Aeronauts. I want to ask you, Felicity, about something you told me about the other day, about a flight you took before production, I think.
Well, on our first day of shooting, we went up in a gas balloon, and we'd been rehearsing the sequence for some time. But on the day, there were a lot of other elements involved, and it was a huge helicopter. They were doing a wide shot of us taking off in the balloon just after the initial takeoff. And we ended up in a situation where the helicopters had got their shot, and they sped off, and we were still floating in the gas air balloon. And the pilot, who was in the corner, told us to throw out the sand, because you power the gas balloon through sand. So obviously the less weight you have, the higher you get. And he suddenly turned around to us and he said, "Throw out the sand, throw out the sand." So we duly did exactly what he wanted, threw out the sand.
To miss some trees
as we were about, because we wanted to land the balloon. We threw out all of the sand, and suddenly he turned around and said that wasn't actually the right thing to do. We'd been misdirected, and then suddenly, having thrown all the sand out of the balloon, we had this incredibly rocky landing and hit the ground at quite a velocity, and almost broke my back, I think.
There was this horrendous crunch because we'd thrown all the sand out. So when we then came down to land, we did actually crash into trees, got caught in the trees, and then the basket came smashing down, and there was this horrific crunch as Felicity's head smacked against the James Glaisher's box that he has in the thing, and then it was just total silence. And I just heard Felicity go, "I'm not sure I can move." And so we had to, and that was when we started. That was day one
of Aeronauts.
Eddie and Felicity, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
The Aeronauts is going to hit theaters on December 6th. You can find it on Amazon on December 20th. But right now, it's among the films playing at the Toronto International Film Festival. And that's where the focus of the film industry went when Telluride wrapped up. Joining me by Skype to compare festival notes is Kyle Buchanan of the New York Times. Hey, Kyle, it feels like we're two film festival ships passing in the middle of the night.
I'm returning from Telluride, and you've just landed at Toronto. What's the vibe like there?
I think very eager to see what's going to transpire. You know, I mean, last year's Best Picture winner, Green Book, emerged from here, kind of a dark horse candidate in a year with really big movies. This year, going into Toronto, you know, which is a festival that often helps clarify the award season, I would say that Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is still sort of our, you know, movie to beat. And we'll have to see if some movies come along that can draw more buzz than that.
I think one thing that kind of distinguishes Toronto from Telluride is that there are a lot of kind of bigger studio movies that come there, including Joker, the, I guess, latest origin story about Joker played by Joaquin Phoenix. How would you describe what studios are after for movies like that that might not be kind of awardsy, but probably are looking for a lot of buzz coming out of festivals?
Well, ironically, Joker was at the Venice Film Festival, and they think it is very awardsy, despite the you know, the comic book trappings. But there are often really big end-of-year spectaculars that come here for a launch. One of those, I would say, this year is Knives Out. It's directed by Rian Johnson, who did The Last Jedi, and it looks like kind of a whodunit, a modern spin on Agatha Christie with an all-star cast that includes Chris Evans, Toni Collette, Daniel Craig. I'm excited for that one. But yeah, by and large, it's a lot of, you know, year-end movies that are vying to be a part of the awards conversation, because there's about to be such a flood of movies, in part because of Netflix. You know, it's going to take a little bit more to stand out, and these movies are hoping that they've got the stuff to do it here first.
In terms of the award season, is it really important to get a lot more momentum out of Toronto than maybe you got at Venice or Telluride? In other words, is it actually more critical than the other festivals in terms of setting up the award season?
Yeah, in some ways, I think Toronto is one of the most populist film festivals, certainly easier and less expensive to get to than Venice or Telluride. But it's also, you know, a festival where the biggest thing that you can get is the audience award. And that's something that often just measures not just, I guess, how conventionally crowd-pleasing a movie is, but will people respond to it in whatever way they're meant to respond to it? And I think that sometimes, you know, we put a lot of stock in what people like you and I think, John, but it's really important to see what really works on a crowd. Last year, going into that Green Book premiere, nobody was expecting really anything from that movie. It was playing very late in the festival, didn't come in with any particular buzz, but it played like gangbusters in the room. It was one of those things that, you know, despite a kind of sometimes bumpy Oscar campaign, I kept returning to, because that's the kind of thing where if it can play there, it can play with Oscar.
I think also the festivals are very important in terms of positioning movies that might look a little like outliers on paper. I have already had the pleasure of seeing Jojo Rabbit, which is Taika Waititi's, I think, amazing movie about World War II and a young boy who thinks he wants to be a Nazi youth. It's a comedy. Taika Waititi plays the boy's imaginary friend who happens to be Adolf Hitler. Is it also important that movies come into Toronto as kind of unknown quantities and leave the festival with people talking about them in ways that you really can't until you see them?
Well, I think one of the wonderful things about any film festival is making a discovery. You know, I mean, when people ask me what movies are you most excited to see, you know, whether I'm going to Toronto, Cannes, or Sundance, sure, I've got a list. You know, there's a lot of movies I can't wait to see that I'm super curious about, like Just Mercy with Michael B. Jordan and Brie Larson. I'm excited to see Waves, which I heard was fantastic at Telluride. It's a movie with Lucas Hedges, Kelvin Harrison Jr. And yeah, I'm curious about films like Joker and Ford versus Ferrari. But what I'm most excited about is to make that discovery, to find something that I didn't know hardly anything about going into the film festival, and then I can shout it from the rooftops.
There are some movies that I'm really eager to see that aren't playing at the festivals, and that includes Little Women, Greta Gerwig's adaptation of the Louisa May Alcott novel. Are there other movies that are oddly missing from the festival scene right now?
I wouldn't say that. There's a lot of year-end movies that will probably pop up at AFI Fest in Los Angeles in November. You know, movies that would be somewhat better served by coming out then, so that the time between a festival debut and a relaunch isn't quite as big. So yes, Little Women, I'd expect to see at AFI. I know Queen and Slim with Daniel Kaluuya will be there. And maybe we'll see a couple things, a couple year-end entries, including Cats. Cats. Cats.
Don't start singing. Don't do it.
No, I won't do that to your audience.
I want to ask you about one last film, and that is Tom Hanks as Fred Rogers in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. That is showing at Toronto, I believe. That also feels like a movie that a lot of people are looking for. I've heard mixed opinions about it based on some people who've seen it. When does it play in Toronto?
It's playing on Saturday night. I'm super curious about it, too. Saturday night is a true collision course of those big studio movies that could potentially become even bigger if critics and audiences respond to them, including Knives Out, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. And honestly, another movie that I screened before the fest that's playing here and that I think will really pop here and when it comes out later this month, which is Hustlers. It's with Jennifer Lopez and Constance Wu. It is just pure fun, but smart with fantastic performances. And I don't think Jennifer Lopez has ever been better. I'm kind of wondering if we could maybe start a drum beat. J-Lo for Best Supporting Actress. J-Lo.
Another one. Kyle Buchanan is the Carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times. He joined us from the Toronto International Film Festival. Kyle, have as much fun as can be had.
I will try. Let's get it. Yes, we're gonna get it. Yo quiero dinero.
Coming up, the new artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Nataki Garrett, on the power of theater, plus an all-female mariachi band that's shaking up tradition. That's next on The Frame Weekend. It's The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. Every year, from early March to late October, the rural town of Ashland, Oregon, is overtaken by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, where they put on a mix of 11 classical and contemporary plays across three stages. The massive endeavor began in 1935, when tickets cost just 50 cents for adults and 25 cents for kids. By now, it's got an operating budget of about $40 million, and the tickets, they're a little pricier. Ashland is just 16 miles north of the California border, but for the new artistic director, Nataki Garrett, it was a lifetime away from her growing up in Oakland. And for that matter, so was Broadway.
The first play I saw on Broadway was recent. As a young person, of course, my mother was a teacher. We couldn't afford Broadway. But as a grown-up and an artist, an artiste out of CalArts, I avoided it. So the first, quiet as it's kept, the first actual production of anything that I saw on Broadway was Sweat.
Wow, Lynn Nottage's play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's interesting when I think about what Broadway represents and what Ashland represents, because I've been to Ashland, and a lot of people go there are people with money and people with privilege, and they tend to be, from my eyes, mostly white.
Yeah.
And that is, in many ways, the Broadway audience. So there is some overlap there. So how do you work with that demographic? How do you embrace them and also challenge them?
They've actually been asking me in every conversation I'm having with my stewarding audience, how are you going to diversify us? What are you going to do to make sure that people are coming, that other people that don't look like us, that are younger than us, that are from different cultural backgrounds? And my question back to them is, yes, what are you going to do? Like, how are you going to assist in that? It's a destination theater. You have to choose to come there. I grew up in Oakland. I'm sure I had friends who went up every year that never spoke about it to me. They never said, why don't you join us on this trip to Ashland?
Why wouldn't they say that?
Oh, it's tough because I know it's an exclusivized experience. It belongs to me. I'm supposed to be the one to go to it. Oh, and then later on when I'm a grown up and I've been working in the theater for 25 years, then they say, you never came? No, I never came. I was not invited. I didn't know anything about it. My mother worked three jobs. You know, that was not a part of my life. But I also feel like you never invited me.
You weren't
is my answer.
Welcomed.
Yeah, like they're not forwardly excluding me from it. What they're doing is not remembering to bring me along as a way of saying this is something for us.
That gets to a fundamental issue that anybody who is running a nonprofit arts organization with a subscriber base faces. And that is, we have these people who are loyal customers and they keep coming year after year after year. And there are these new audiences that we want to develop. And often the new audience and the old audience aren't going to agree on the same thing. So how do we retain these people that are our lifeblood and give new audiences something that they're attracted to and maybe challenge these existing subscribers to open their minds to new kinds of art?
See, I think we're asking the wrong question.
Okay.
So I think the question is, how can we create a space where people feel confident enough to share their armchair rest with everybody else? That's where I think we have to ask. We have to figure out where is that intersection that traverses the divide between age and race and gender that says it's okay for me to sit next to you while we witness that. And that's what I have to start to teach my audience.
You can take a classic play and you can stage it in a way and it can tell a new story. So when you think about classic works that can be reexamined, is it important to you to look at how these works live and breathe in the modern world? And does that feel exciting to you or is it difficult?
It's both. It's both difficult and exciting. There are some plays written by, you know, our namesake playwright, Shakespeare, where I'm just appalled. And I know he's a man of his time, and it's really important to separate time from now. But I had somebody write me a letter where they wanted me to be aware of the impact of the work of Shakespeare on a new audience. And when we forgive because he's a man of his time, we forgive him for stories about rape and incest and stories about racism and stories that are anti-Semitic, anti-disability. When you have all of those things happening in a play, then you package it and you say, well, this is high art and you're supposed to like this. And if you don't like it, there's something wrong with you. And then you present that to middle school children or you present that to high schoolers or college age people. And you're basically saying to them, you should figure out a way to accept this. This should be something that you should swallow. And so I think as a person who produces Shakespeare, I have to be very clear about the impact that I'm making. And where I have the most control is in the image. The word is powerful because of the image, because how the body holds it. That's where I can make the difference.
We're talking with Nataki Garrett, who is the new artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Good art is about conversation, and it's about a conversation that happens on many different levels. What can theater do that movies, music, TV, visual art can't do? What is the unique power of theater in conversation?
There's something about witnessing humanity live with other humans. There's something chemical or physiological that shifts in your heart and your brain and in your blood where you realize you're watching something, you're being a voyeur, you're watching something terrible, you're watching something delicious and funny, you're witnessing something and you're breathing the air with other people. That organic experience is something that is kind of singular to the theater. And I think that's the separation. It's not a concert, right, where you have a barrier, and it's not a dance show where people aren't speaking. It's all of those things at once, and it's happening organically.
Your first season won't be unveiled until 2021, but when you were thinking about, it's kind of like a fantasy football draft when you're picking your players, what are you looking for and what are you not looking for?
One of the things that I'm focused on as an artistic director and as an artist is I'm looking for a way to open our capacity for empathy through the work that we do. And the plays that I'm inspired by are plays that remind us of our basic humanity and inspire us to action so that we can create spaces where people can live their full dynamic lives. And that's extremely important to me as an artist and as a human being. And as an artistic director, my goal is to locate those plays and try to figure out first, if they can give us a deeper sense of who we are in our profound humanity, and if they can lead us towards the possibility for a better future, a brighter future, and a future for the people that we're raising to populate this world. If they don't do those things, then I'm not interested in it. And that's including Shakespeare. When I do produce Shakespeare, I'm looking for a way to shake things up in the way that the populist playwright Shakespeare was looking for a way to shake things up and engage. Shakespeare wrote plays for royalty so that he could afford to write the plays for the people. And I'm interested in the gap between those two spaces as well. And I'm interested in the intersection between those two spaces. And that's how I program a season, looking for new plays, new writers, new ideas, new thoughts, new forms. And then the last thing is, how will those plays affect the people on the other side of the footlights? What happens to my audience when I'm asking them to engage with each other in their experience of witnessing a story?
Nataki Garrett is the new artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland, Oregon. Nataki, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. They play traditional instruments, and they can belt out classic Mexican songs. But the New York-based group Flor de Tolo Ache is not your granddad's mariachi. As The Frame contributor Beto Arcos reports, this all-female group is creating a new musical style, blending mariachi sounds with R&B.
It's midday at the LATV studios in West LA, and Mariachi Flor de Tolo Ache is warming up for a performance on one of the cable channel shows. After the performance, I sat down with the leading members of Flor de Tolo Ache for an interview. Violinist and singer Mireya Ramos grew up in Puerto Rico. Her mother is from the Dominican Republic. Her father was a mariachi musician from Michoacán, Mexico. Ramos says one day she felt a calling.
I had the desire to collaborate with other women. I was one of the only female musicians playing mariachi in New York City during that time. This is about 7 years before 2008. And I just wanted to do my own arrangements as well and my own compositions.
In 2008, Ramos called Cuban-American singer and guitarist Shay Fiol. They met through a mutual friend from the R&B scene, and together they decided to form the group Flor de Tolo Ache. In the beginning, they played all the usual mariachi gigs, quinceañeras, weddings, birthdays, funerals, and they were also buskers, playing in Manhattan subway stations. Singer Shay Fiol says the subway gigs helped to audition potential new members.
We also knew who was committed by the ones that would come out to the subway with us, of the players. And then we got to try out a lot of new stuff. It was basically like rehearsal, like a paid rehearsal with an audience. But that wasn't technically a show.
There was one thing they had clear from the get-go. Their goal as a group was to do a fusion of mariachi and other music styles. Violinist Mireya Ramos.
It wouldn't be genuine to us to do traditional mariachi because none of the girls actually come from mariachi tradition other than me. And I wasn't raised in Mexico. My approach to the mariachi was from far away, from Puerto Rico. So even for me, it wasn't that genuine to do just traditional Mexican mariachi. So the goal was always to do new arrangements and to kind of experiment with the genre.
When they decided to record their first album, Fiol says they needed songs.
And we had some of our own songs written already from our own projects. And then we're like, well, let's bring these in and do them Flor de Tolo Ache style. And so Let Down was one of the first ones. And it definitely had R&B vocals already. But what we needed to do was adapt it to using the guitarrón and the vihuela and the trumpets, you know, put all these different mariachi, like technical styles, into the song.
And to you I was the gold you saw at the bottom of, at the bottom of the street.
For their new album titled Indestructible, Flor de Toloache collaborated on a song titled Te Lo Dije with the pop singer Miguel, who happens to be Ramos's cousin.
You know, it's an amazing experience to be in the studio with him. And also, it was so emotional because his grandmother and my grandmother used to sing together in Mexico, in Michoacán, Mexico. They used to have a duet called El Dueto Heredia, and Heredia is their last name. And they had just passed away not too long ago before the session. So it was a really emotional session. It felt like they were there with us and that they made this whole thing happen for us, you know. So it was really pretty.
For the song Quisiera, Shay Fiol says their producer, Rafa Sardina, offered to invite pop singer John Legend.
He's like, well, let me see, you know, I'll talk to him and we'll see if, you know, we can sing in Spanish, but we wrote in English first just in case. Mm-hmm. And he was into it. And so, you know, we're like, okay, we shot for the stars. Let's shoot for the stars and think of who would we want to sing on this album. John Legend, of course.
Still, Cuban-American singer-guitarist Shay Fiol says there's a certain responsibility that comes with being part of a mariachi group, playing Mexican music.
Not being Mexican, there's a lot of pressure.
Right.
You got to show up and really know your stuff. And not only that, but, you know, respect the tradition and the culture because mm-hmm. people are looking at you because you're not.
You're
so
right.
They want to be like, and?
Yeah.
What are you doing? And why?
Flor de Toloache won a Latin Grammy for Best Mariachi Album in 2017 for their album called Las Caras Lindas. Despite all the recognition, violinist Mireya Ramos says they're still criticized for not following the traditional mariachi aesthetic.
They still come to us and say, oh, that doesn't look good. You should wear a skirt, you know. Oh, those shoes don't look good. Even our hair, it should be back and that curly and out, you know. It's like, it's wrong. It's like there's these mariachi laws that we shouldn't cross. And I don't know who put them there.
And why they can't
be. I asked the members of Flor de Toloache to tell me the story behind the band's name. They said Flor de Toloache is a desert flower. It's also called Devil's Trumpet, and its seed is protected by spikes. It's a flower you don't want to mess with. It's fair to say the band lives up to its name. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
Coming up on The Frame Weekend, filmmakers Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman's new film, Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice.
We really came to see her story as one of empowerment. And she was a woman who was making it in a male world, this music world that was controlled by men, and making it on her own terms, and a pioneer in that regard.
That's next on The Frame Weekend. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Singer Linda Ronstadt is probably most well known for belting vocals and rock hit after rock hit, but the true Ronstadt fan knows that the musician, now 73, was much more than a rock star. She was a musical innovator. A stunning range from opera to mariachi standards to Frank Sinatra songs, filmmakers Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman took up Ronstadt as the subject in their new film, Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice. I want to play an early song that Linda Ronstadt records, and first I'm going to play a clip from the film, and this song might be familiar to a lot of people who know Linda Ronstadt's songs. So this one is called Different Drum.
Whoa, you and I travel to the beat of a different drum.
So that's her recording of it or performance of it in the film. And this is the version that probably most of us have heard. So I'm going to ask you a little bit about the people that Linda Ronstadt worked with, what role the producers and engineers played in the development of her music, because same song, but a very different sound.
The producer had a very strong idea of what the arrangement was going to be for that. And Linda at first was taken aback when she heard it because she was so used to the folky version. So it took her a while to make that adjustment, but of course she realizes that that's what helped to make it a hit. People may not realize that it was originally written by a man, Michael Nesmith, who went on to become part of the Monkees. And the song's about a man not wanting to get tied down to any one woman, and Linda turned that on its head. We really came to see her story as one of empowerment.
The rock and roll culture is so male dominated, and it also seems to be dominated by sort of a hostility against women, you know, that this sort of sexual identity that is sort of used as a weapon against the populace, you know, and women in particular, and then everyone identifies with it.
And she was a woman who was making it in a male world, this music world that was controlled by men, and making it on her own terms, and a pioneer in that regard.
Linda Ronstadt had an unbelievable range, and she could sing anything. It felt like she was always hungry. She wanted to try new things, if it was a comic opera, if it was old standards. Why was she so driven to not stay just doing rock? What was behind that motivation, do you think?
She is an artist, and I think she was just restless and unsatisfied to keep repeating what she'd been doing in the past. She describes it as having to sing the same thing over and over again until it starts to sound like your washing machine. But these are genres and styles that she grew up listening to, and they were all part of her authentic musical DNA.
We learned so much about singing from each other. It was completely incorporated into what we did. We sang at the dinner table. We sang in the car. We sang with our hands in the dishwater.
And they were things that she wanted to get back to. It was the music that she loved. And at a certain point in her career, she was successful enough to be able to say, okay, I want to do something completely different now.
Yeah, along those same lines, she was told no a lot of times by record executives. And I think, as was often the case, when they said no, they wished they had said yes. So the album is called Canciones de mi Padre, Songs of My Father, and it not only is critically successful, I think to this day it's the largest selling Spanish language album in U.S. recorded music history. Is that right?
I think that still holds.
Why was that important to her? And when she was told no, how did she get around that? How did she prevail?
Yeah, well, the record companies were baffled by her choices at that point in her career, but she was bound and determined. And as she says at one point in an interview in the film from that period, she said, "This is music. If I don't do, I will die." I mean, she was a musical adventurer. Once she had her sights on what that next adventure was going to be, it was going to happen come hell or high water.
And listen to that voice. She's so, I mean, it's just a completely different part of her voice than we've heard, I think, in any of the incarnations before.
For Linda, she says that's when she really felt like she was a singer, when she became a singer, when she mastered the canciones.
There's a scene toward the end of the film in which Linda Ronstadt is singing or trying to sing, and it's very touching. I think some people could read it as heartbreaking. I thought it was beautiful. What was it like to film the scene with Linda with Parkinson's trying to sing?
We wanted to find a way to include Linda in the present tense, knowing the condition that she said she wasn't willing or able to do a sit-down interview. Late in the game, she was doing this trip to Mexico and invited our cameras to participate and let us film this very intimate scene of her singing with her nephew and her cousin. And I think from Linda's perspective, it felt like a very natural, organic way to let the audience in on her present tense without making any kind of issue of it, without making any kind of point. It was just a moment where you get to see her living her life very fully, completely engaged. Music is still very much a part of her life. As she says, she still sings in her mind. And this was a rare moment where she's also singing very intimately with family.
Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman's new documentary is called Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice. Rob and Jeffrey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice is in theaters now, and you're listening to The Frame Weekend. Is this it, or is this the back of some abandoned building?
I don't think people generally see it during the day.
So for our last story today, the Frame news clerk Andrea Gutierrez and I traveled to Koreatown. It's where we met up with filmmaker Justin Chan. His latest film is called Miss Purple. It's about a young woman caring for her ailing father. She's a pianist, but she has to put her music on hold and find a job. And she ends up working as a hostess in a karaoke bar. We met up with Chan at Soup Soak. That's the bar where he shot most of his film.
Well, let's take a look inside. Oh, we got the lights on, the mirror ball. Lights.
So this is a room that final scene was shot in, the intense scene.
Yo, Casey, pour him a f***ing drink. Pour him a f***ing drink.
What's up, beautiful?
How you pour him a f***ing drink?
How you doing?
Have a seat. And then pour us a drink.
When you were thinking about making this movie, did you start with a character who was caring for her ailing father? Was her job working in karaoke bars essential? What was the nature of how those two things came together?
The first and foremost thing is I wanted to tell a story about a brother and sister, specifically that dynamic, because I have a younger sister and I haven't really seen it explored much in film other than You Can Count on Me, The Savages, Skeleton Twins. And I knew I wanted to set it in Koreatown because, you know, growing up and coming here so often, it was a different place in the 80s and 90s. And now it's become such a gentrified neighborhood that sometimes I don't even recognize it. And I wanted to tell a story about the people who are still here and they grew up here. And it almost sometimes feel like it's a time machine and that has moved forward, but they've been left behind. And that always fascinates me, and sort of the idea of unfulfilled dreams and people who come to this country and don't quite fulfill what they set out to do.
Do you ever wonder where the money comes from?
I know where it comes from.
Does it bother you?
No. Casey, it doesn't bother me. Casey, whatever you had to do to keep Dad alive, I don't I don't judge you for it, okay?
I wanted her to have a job that was compromising because I thought that that really showcased how stuck in her own world and how stuck in the position she was in and something that she needed to break free of. In Korean, it's called Doumi, which means literally means helper. And basically, they come and it's sort of you're paying for companionship. But the reality of it is, in present day, it's a very big mix of girls, and a lot of these girls are either trying to pay off, you know, credit card debt or student loans. And during our research, we even found like girls who are trying to make business connections. So some people utilize it for their own sort of business building in a weird way.
We're talking with Justin Chan, the writer and director of Miss Purple. There are a couple of relationships that you're examining. One is a brother-sister relationship, and the other is a father and mother relationship. And the mother of these children makes a choice that is radically different from the daughter.
Yes.
The mom says, see ya. Mm-hmm. And the daughter, I think, feels an obligation mm-hmm. to stick around yeah. and not take something that might be more attractive.
Yeah, and I think a theme that I do consistently explore in my films is collateral baggage, like the baggage you bring from the old country and the customs, and what are the things that you should keep intact and what are the things that you should shed once you come to a new country and assimilate. And there is a dichotomy that is very obvious where the mother lived her own life and you know, deserted the family, but then the daughter's stuck and she has this filial sort of duty.
If she didn't have to figure out how to care for her father, would she be playing piano? What was the dream that she gave up and why did she have to give it up?
Yeah, you know, at the midpoint in the film, she does talk about, you know, her brother kind of says, hey, you know, look what I found. And he finds like a tiny electric keyboard in the closet. He asks her,
listen, you used to love playing that thing. You went to school for fucking piano.
Yeah,
how do you
know?
Not...
I went to school for piano.
Yeah, and you didn't finish. I mean, you liked it, right?
Yeah, I liked it.
So why did you finish school?
Dad?
I think that's pretty common. You know, I've heard a lot of people that I know, personal friends, who were really great at something that they loved and had to give it up to help run their parents' store. Or help their parents with their business. And it felt very true to me. But if the dad had not gotten sick, and the dad is such a dark reminder that the American dream doesn't always, it's not all roses. Sometimes it doesn't go in your favor. And the two kids are sort of casualties of that.
There are some very specific things about L.A. in this film. There's a line about how even the palm trees are not native. Mm-hmm. And then there's a shot of the piano in Union Station where people mm-hmm. can actually play. How did you cast the city in this film?
Specifically in Koreatown, there's a constant theme of green. And green to me equated money. And I remember one time a friend from New York, we had hung out and he's like, yeah, man, the only thing I notice or kind of feel about LA is all the damn palm trees. And I'm like, what? No, there's no palm. Like, what? That's a stereotype. There's no palm trees in LA. And he's like, what? Like, they're everywhere. And then I remember coming back from a trip, that trip we were on, and I came back and I looked up and there are palm trees everywhere. I had never, but it's so symbolic. The thing I wanted to say is you don't take the time to look up. And the metaphor of the palm trees, they're not from here. They're all transplanted here like all of us are, but they're dying. I mean, palm trees aren't meant to be in this climate. And it was such a great metaphor for me for who belongs here.
We're in this room at Soup Soak, and inside this room, there's a scene that involves violence. Mm-hmm. And it's not just that it's a violent scene, but it's that it is violence committed by men against women that seems ordinary and acceptable.
I knew I wanted to have a female protagonist, and I found myself trying to make everything fair. If something bad happens to her, something good has to happen to her. And I realized I was doing a disservice if I wasn't being honest. And what needed to happen, I felt for Casey, the main character, is that she was so stuck in this mindset and going at it alone and feeling like taking the whole burden of the world. And for her, she, as a woman, she feels so alone. But there are so many people that would, you know, just are there to support her. She just scared to ask. And I feel like, especially in my community, the women, especially the older generation, they are really scared to ask for help. Hopefully, with my generation, the generation younger, it's you don't have to be ashamed to ask, because there's plenty of people who are there for you.
Justin, great to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, John.
Thank you guys so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Ms. Purple is in theaters now. And that will do it for this edition of The Frame Weekend. The show is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by Herb and Jonathan Shiflett, Robert Garova, and Julia Paskin. Valentino Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. Our opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. And our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn from the Moen Broadcast Center here at KPCC. Thanks for listening. Have a safe and happy weekend. We'll be back on Monday with the daily version of The Frame.